Hello, everybody. Everybody there? Woo. Welcome to the U.S. Imagine Cup 2016 Finals! Woo! A little louder. We are excited to have 15 teams battle for the chance to win $4,000 and the opportunity to advance to the global world semifinals. Make some noise. So the Imagine Cup, 14 years in a row, it has inspired thousands of students across the globe to be able to challenge today's problems with their new technology and innovative solutions. Our teams today are here because they are continuing to challenge the status quo through their technologies, and they will be competing in three categories: innovation, citizenship, and games. So before we go over to the winners, I want to talk about the journey. There were 15 teams that came from all over the country. They came from as far as Boston, Rochester, New York, University of Hawaii. Shout outs to all of them. And they are here today through grueling trials, through pitch trainings, through hours of preparation. They even went so far as to meet Satya Nadella yesterday. And so we are excited to have them here to pitch their technology solutions and also demo privately to our judges. So get excited. Let me make some noise for U.S. Imagine Cup. So another thing to really kick off today is we have expanded this program to not only have more finalist teams, so there's 15 teams, which is the most we've had in some time, but we also have more VIP judges. Make some noise for our judges, which we'll kick off. We have three VIP judges per category that are senior leaders in their respective fields in Silicon Valley and within Microsoft. And they will be able to judge the students from a 5-minute pitch perspective, which will be here on stage. And they also will get the opportunity to look at those teams' specific projects from a demo perspective. So we're super excited to have all those judges there, and we'll start and kick them off soon. So one other thing to call out about the judging, just so you guys know structure, we are gonna be close to timing. So it's 5-minute pitch, 5-minute Q&A from our judges, and I would love to kick them off. So the first part of the category that we're gonna kick off is gonna be innovation. Innovation team, make some noise. And for innovation, we actually have 5 teams that will compete for the chance to win $4,000 and advance to the world semifinals. But first, I'm going to introduce our VIP judges that will be able to assess their projects. So first, we have Ashley Crowder. Ashley is a driven visionary who leverages her engineering background to guide Ventana's overall direction and technology development. She co-founded Ventana Interactive Hologram Technologies in 2012 with the goal of allowing people to be in multiple venues at the same time. Since then, Ventana has created the first scalable, affordable, and interactive hologram system, which has been used by major brands including Microsoft, Pepsi, and Mercedes-Benz. Give a round of applause for Ashley Crowder. We also have Jonathan Nelson, which is the founder and CEO of Hackers and Founders. It's the largest group of tech founders globally with 200,000 members in 118 cities and 44 countries. Hackers and Founders organizers produce 40 events every week around the world. Hackers and Founders Accelerator, HF Co-op, has worked with 50 startups that have a combined market capitalization of $400 million. Jonathan is a serial entrepreneur and software engineer living in Silicon Valley. Make some noise for Jonathan Nelson. And lastly, but certainly not least, we have Jeff Ramos. He is a senior director and business owner of the Microsoft Garage, a place and community that serves tens of thousands of employees and interns with programs enabling innovation and collaboration, such as Project Oxford, that a lot of our teams are leveraging today. Ramos runs the Garage and Maker Garage facilities on the Microsoft Redmond campus, as well as leading global chapters, the intern program, the one-week hackathon, and the Microsoft Garage customer-facing channel for shipping, apps, and other great projects. Please welcome Jeff Ramos. And so we are going to kick this off with our five innovation teams. The way we're going to structure it is we're going to have each team step to the stage, present on screen for 5 minutes again, and have our judges ask Q&A for 5 minutes. We have our timers also available to make sure we're adhering to that time. And we are going to kick things off with our first team. Please give us a warm welcome in welcoming Gunlock.
When one in every five Californians own a firearm, whether it's you, your neighbors, or your neighbor's neighbors, gun security should be on your mind. And when 89% of gun deaths among children occur in the home, whether it's your home or the home of one of your children's friends, gun security should be on your mind. And when 1.69 million American children are living in homes with loaded and unlocked firearms, security should be a priority. It's a story we've heard too many times. Let's say you're at work and your kids are at home. If someone is playing with your gun, if someone is tampering with your firearm, there's no way to know about it. It's something that you'd have to wait until you get home from work to figure out, or God forbid, you get a concerned call from a neighbor. So we ask the following question. Does a gun owner that is not at home know whether or not their firearm is absolutely secure? From 2005 to 2010, 3,800 people in the United States alone died from unintentional shootings. Of those, 1,300 were under the age of 25. Would this statistic change with the opportunity for immediate response? Introducing Gunlock. Gunlock is an aftermarket gun accessory that alerts a user when a firearm is moved and gives gun owners peace of mind. We aim to bring firearms into the Internet of Things by providing real-time tamper detection alerts through a web application and through SMS notifications. We have built a platform-agnostic way to deliver critical information about a firearm security, any platform, any device. The user starts by purchasing one of our devices and putting it on their gun. They then register for an account using our online system and are immediately able to access our dashboard, where they're able to upload, manage their firearms. This puts the security of their loved ones directly at their fingertips. Additionally, a user is able to link up a phone number with their account, so they can receive real-time alerts about their gun security status directly to their mobile device. This means that you are connected to your loved ones and making sure they are safe at anywhere. And when the average American gun owner has 8 firearms, and there are over 271 million firearms in the US alone, it's this opportunity for immediate response that makes Gunlock so powerful. When we deliver a text message alert, we give you the make and model of the firearm that was tampered with, the timestamp at which the event occurred, and we give you instructions on how to contact local authorities. Gunlock provides a price point that is unmatched in the current market. With our current production costs, we can cut a fraction of current entry-level security devices in the gun accessory market. We have a consumer-centric design that lets users simply walk into a gun store, pick out our product, and attach it directly to their firearm. And with this, Gunlock defines a new product space for tamper detection products. So how do we get it to gun store shelves? Well, you need to go through a distributor. And we've heard the stories. Gun distributors are hard to reach. You have to send tons of emails, play phone tag for weeks, but we decided to give it a try. So we tried to get in touch with the RSR group. They responded to our email within 3 hours asking for a prototype. An RSR group is an ideal distributor for Gunlock. They have a Southeast sales center located in Florida, our home state. They do exclusive contracts with accessory manufacturers. So while they stay loyal to brands, they allow manufacturers of one accessory to get on their shelves and in their catalogs. And additionally, when they do trial runs of new products, they ask for a batch of about 100 to 200 devices to test market viability. So how do we get that initial batch? Crowdfunding. Kickstarter is an excellent platform for raising the initial capital needed to get Gunlock into the hands of RSR Group. And with gun security being such a hot topic in today's society, having a Kickstarter campaign will appeal to both gun owners and non-gun owners alike. So it's an excellent way to raise that initial funding. But at the end of the day, what do we have here? Gunlock isn't just a gun tampering detection system. Gunlock is a platform technology. And the real innovation here is the mobility of tampering detection. The technology behind Gunlock can be expanded to so many devices all across the field. And at the end of the day, our team chose the problem of gun security because it's something that is important to us. And the information that Gunlock provides empowers gun owners and gives them the choice of how to protect their loved ones. And that resulting security is absolutely priceless. Thank you. So,
Wonderful job. Everyone give them another round of applause. So now we're going to open it up for our VIP judges to provide their questions.
Great presentation.
Thank you.
So who are your competitors, or who do you consider to be your competitors?
Right. So one of the biggest devices that we found was going away from sort of gun accessory manufacturers and looking at safe manufacturers, there's a company, Liberty Safes. They're big in the gun safe field. They have a product called Safe Alert. It's a device that you can put inside of a safe that sort of does the same sort of thing. When you open a safe, it will send you a notification on an Android app or an iOS app. And so, first of all, you know, not everyone owns a safe. And especially like entry-level gun owners, you might only own one or two. Most people just have like a home safety rather than, you know, a $200, $300 safe. And additionally, so the price point of Safe Alert is about $200 for a consumer version, and our product retails for about $50, $60. Yep.
So my question is around, is this working? Yeah. My question is around like what working prototypes you have, both from a device point of view and from your platform point of view, and then if you could just maybe add, you talked about uploading the weapon type. Do you have a catalog?
Sure. So, you want to talk about the platform?
Okay. So the hardware that we have that does the tamper detection on the gun itself, it's something that you can attach, and it works on any firearm. And then it contains like a Bluetooth module that connects to a typical smart home's IoT backend. And then it uses that to communicate with our web application that we have. And that web application, it allows users to input the guns that they have, enter in a specific ID that we assign to them. And so that way, every time there's a tamper detected, it goes all the way through our stack and then ends up with an alert to the user's phone.
Yeah, so right now the current version is we have this device that you can attach to the gun. We have the fully fleshed out software backend, and you asked, we currently don't have a list of like makes and models of firearms, but that's definitely like an easy field to add.
Have you guys actually tried this out? Do you have like alpha or beta tests like in the field in people's homes?
No alpha beta tests in people's homes. We've mostly been using a Nerf gun to sort of field test our product, but just playing around with different accelerometer sensitivities and sort of understanding what works best.
We do have interest from the distributor.
Yeah, and like we have interest from the distributor, but TBD.
my dad has about 15 guns. I suspect he'd enjoy something like this for his grandkids, or to keep his guns away from his grandkids.
Sure.
So you sell the device and then the service as well?
Yes. So we were playing around with different ideas as to how to price everything. Sort of the idea of a subscription model for the service came up as an idea. But I think that in the end of the day, we'd rather just have the accessory itself be that flat price point and keep it low, keep it entry level. A subscription service could be used if, I don't know, we decided to go enterprise level with this and have like a gun store keep tags on all of its firearms. But right now it's just the accessory, and it comes packaged with access to the software.
So even with this like flat price point, it's like really the software on the software side, it doesn't cost us much, because this is basically the infrastructure on Azure, so it scales really easily. And for subscriptions, we can have things like we can create a mobile app for people who want to have that instead of text messages, or maybe have a different ways for users to access the same portal. But still, subscription wouldn't be totally necessary, just because the device is the main selling point.
You mentioned that it would have to connect to a Nest or similar device in a house, so someone would have to own a Nest or similar in their home for this to work?
Yeah.
Not necessarily. Anything that can just connect to the Bluetooth module and have a connection to the internet would work. So, I mean, we could interface with any smart home system. We could also produce a module that doesn't require that. It just connects to your router.
Yeah, and right now, right now we just have, our test is we just have a laptop that connects to the device via Bluetooth, and we have like an easy applet running that takes care of that monitoring. Yep. All right, thank you.
Give them another round of applause. Wonderful job. Next up, we have HealthX.
Imagine that with one eye, your good eye, you see this on the left. And with your other eye, you see this blurry pan of view. That's what it's like to have lazy eye. Lazy eye affects 1 in 40 children. To put that in perspective, on average, that would mean you have at least 10 Facebook friends who have or have had this disorder. Left untreated, lazy eye can cause permanent eye damage and does not repair itself. It goes on into adulthood. Current methods of, 50%. Of all kids who are preschool aged who have lazy eye go undiagnosed, and it stays with them throughout their life. Current methods of diagnosis include a complete optical examination, which is difficult for young children to sit through. Treatment involves patching and blinding the good eye and forcing the weaker eye to work. This is difficult for kids, and it can take a long time. It's embarrassing, it makes writing hard, school in general. We want to change this paradigm. HealthX is an eye tracking game designed to diagnose and treat lazy eye.
Thank you, Daniel. So imagine you're going to hospital with your kid, playing 5 minutes of video game that can save your kid's eye for the rest of his life. Imagine a video game can be a doctor. You know what? We're already there. This is Lily, a 4-year-old girl that's currently doing our treatment in our clinical trials. She's having a lot of fun. We love this kid. No more batching, no more eye drops, no more anything. This is proven. This is the game. HealthX, basic mechanic of HealthX. You look at there as you move around. You look at the enemies, you shoot them. The way the enemies that move, the path they follow, and the size of the enemies, all of those are triggers for lazy eye. Once lazy eye being triggered, we can make all the diagnostic decision about that. This is the tool, a very primitive tool right now, that we write for optometrists. We visualize the data for them. What you can see in the screen is just the pupil position and the screen. We represent the gaze of a player where he was looking around with some information about the patient condition. According to our knowledge, we are the first one to provide a daily basis status update for a lazy eye patient, usually it takes 3 months visitation for each patient to come back. And that result, the eye become weaker, the batching eye becoming weaker, and the other one will go wrong. So no balancing. We providing the first monitoring tool for ophthalmologists. This game has been collaboration with top-tier medical professionals, engineers, and business monitors. We're going to be ready for market in 4 months. Thank you.
So the market here is really straightforward. Quick back of the napkin, bottom up, you got amblyopia affects 9 million people in the US. We're proposing a $140 per use fee. It's yet to be determined completely. But that gives you a rough estimate of $1.26 billion domestic market just in our screening and diagnostic function. Global market, there's a lot more variables, so we're not going to get into that. The key takeaways here from a business viability standpoint, lazy eye diagnostic market is severely underserved. That's why we got into this. That's how we figured it out. We have a few competitors that are doing treatment. No software competitors doing diagnostic. We are currently in clinical trials. We've been in clinical trials for about 3 months, and we have seen preliminary positive feedback. We have two primary schools in Utah that are interested in our systems, and they will be the first schools that utilize a software solution to diagnose and treat lazy eye. Our business model is B2B with a per-use fee structure, which is just a really convenient and scalable model to have. And we have really small cost of goods sold relative to the margin that we're generating. So hopefully our profit margin will be huge as long as we can actually maintain our expenses relatively well. So through screening, diagnosis, and training, and treatment, lazy eye, HealthX is restoring vision one game at a time. Thank you.
So if you're charging per use, how many times does a typical patient need to play the game?
If it's diagnosis once, so far it seems like it's about a few minutes for your average screening and diagnosis, 5 minutes. But that's the per use for diagnosis. And then if there's a treatment, which we haven't fully developed yet, so we don't want to get too much into that, but treatment will be an at-home solution that'll cost more. It's a different model entirely.
Nice presentation, good job. I understood the treatment part, but I think I kind of missed the diagnosis piece. So what were you actually doing to create the diagnosis? And then perhaps you can address why a clinical trial is necessary.
Okay. So basically, lazy eyes there's different degrees of lazy eyes, and one of them is like really easy hitting by kids, so they can really not show it to parents and everybody else. So what we do in the game, we try to write an algorithm that make the screen as chaotic as possible to force your eyes wandering all around. That forces lazy eye to appear, meaning by appear, start wandering and make an offset between your both eyes. Once that offset being detected, we can detect the degree of lazy eye, the severity of the condition. We use an eye tracker methodology. We have an eye tracker that tracks the position of the eye. So the whole game is fully controlled by eye's movement.
Can you talk about who's doing your clinical trials and like how many patients are you actually using it or how many people are going through it?
Yeah. So we are working with University of Utah Hospital and Moraine Eye Center and Rivington Hospital. All of those hospitals are based in Utah currently. We are seeing per day. So in outpatient clinic, we see 40 patients per day. And in hospital, we see 5 to 10 per week. So we currently in 3 months, so we have almost about, I think, 120 valid data.
And how does your process compare on a cost basis with the clinical ophthalmologist actually doing the exam?
So the current status quo, from what we can tell, is about 220 in our region per like full eye exam. Now, granted, it's not 100% comparable because a full eye exam will result in, you know, if you have things other than lazy eye. However, lazy eye is the most common thing that kids have. And also, our technology is scalable to other conditions as well. So if we can scale this and create an environment where we can scan for other conditions, then our price point, you know, at $140 rather than $220, and it happens at the school or at the ophthalmologist clinic, just waiting room, for a few minutes, it's a totally different, yeah.
I have what I hope will not be a very difficult question, but your cause is very noble. Mm-hmm. So have you had discussions as a team about the nobility of making your solution available at no cost? Have you discussed this?
Yes, true. And that's one of the things we hopefully in the very soon we're funding, because FDA approval coming in the way for sure, because we're like as low classification FDA approval, we thought actually for setting a Kickstarter where we can like collect money for fund sources, and as a reward, we're gonna deploy these systems in like third world countries and stuff like that. That's for sure.
We've got a lot of flexibility because we have such a huge profit margin on what we're planning here with the schools who've already expressed interest, that we can then do other screenings in other places for much less and try and get this so we can catch more of the 50% of kids who go undiagnosed.
It's great that the schools have expressed interest, but who's paying for it at the schools? Would it be the parents, or have you looked into insurance?
So insurance is something that we're currently looking at, and that's, you caught me on that. But currently we're trying to see if we can get the State Department to pay for it, because there are actually four states where it's mandatory to screen for lazy eye. And within those states, Missouri, I think, is one of them, less than 40% of the kids actually get the screening. And that's because of compliance issues, that's because of cost issues to parents. So we're trying to see if we can address as many issues as possible and try and see if we can get the state to pay for it. If that doesn't work, insurance will potentially cover it, but we don't know yet, so too early. All right, thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Please give a round of applause for HealthX again. Next up, we have Dora that we'd like to invite to the stage.
So everyone here has probably interacted with or at least heard of in some capacity products like Dora, products like Cortana, Siri, maybe even an Amazon Echo. So we're here today to introduce to you Dora, which takes all the convenience and usability of voice interaction with a productive device, but we take it to the visual space. So what is Dora? The premise of it, it's a foam dart gun that essentially employs facial recognition to shoot passerbyers if they are not recognized or if they're strangers to our database, and they'll leave you alone if you are in our database. But that sounds like a toy, and we're here to show you why it's so much more. So our biggest feature is that you can customize the database for the facial recognition really easily. So we have a web app and a mobile app in which you can, in very simple steps, it takes approximately 5 seconds to update your friends' faces, your own face, in order to ensure that those people, when they're passing by Dora, are not shot by our system. And for us as young adults who are living in shared spaces, such as dorm rooms or with our families, we can track and easily keep track of who is in our area wherever Dora is installed.
So our simplest form of interaction starts with voice commands. Right now we have implemented a shoot method, which just shoots on demand instead of waiting for Dora to actually do it. And we also have a play music command to integrate with our full like entertainment system. So we have, like, for example, Play Music would play a song from one of our playlists. And we wanted to like make that more of a natural experience instead of having the hassle of a computer. So we've also, to continue stepping up with our facial recognition feature, we've installed a new app store called Virtual Playground, which basically allows users to enter a whole new world and use like their hand gestures and facial movements in a more like natural way to interact with the computer and see what's going on with them. Right now we have installed two just for fun. We have like a Pokemon arena, so you can like see yourself holding a Pokeball and moving around with it, as well as a basketball gym to like dribble a ball or move it around. We really wanted to focus on a seamless user experience. So as mentioned before, we have integrated a web app as well as a universal Windows app that both contribute to the same database and allow users to easily add and remove their friends from the list wherever they are. We also have it so that you can monitor Dora's interactions with the real world while you aren't there. We made the UI as simple as possible so that you wouldn't have to deal with like all the backend stuff that other services tend to have.
All right, so what does Dora look like as a commercial product? Right now, we have the hardware unit that we would be shipping to our users. It consists of the Kinect serving as a camera, the microprocessor controlling the IoT aspect that's triggering the gun, and the foam dart gun. So we would be shipping this. We estimate prices once we've replaced all our current technology with cheaper alternatives to be a $40 price per unit. And since we have developed an app store concept in which users can add these virtual environments, we anticipate that those would be sold individually as well for prices under $5, similar to apps you would buy on your phone or on your Xbox. And then again, we would also want to implement this in large events. We've had a lot of fun demoing it here, and we would see that companies could use this in the lobbies of their large venues and things like that for an entertainment service for their whoever's in their building at one time. So for that, we would implement a pay-per-use API call system in which we would profit in that way as well. We're mainly targeting young adolescents and young adults who are living in shared spaces, such as ourselves. It was inspired by our personal experiences with pesky roommates, things like that. And looking ahead, our main problem, or not problem, but step, is to move from prototype to product. So right now we're interfacing with a lot of great Microsoft technology using Project Oxford, Azure, and the Kinect to really build an ecosystem, and that has really maintained our technology efficiency. But looking ahead, we'd like to actually replace these with customized parts that we would build with funding we would receive here or otherwise to build cheaper alternatives so that we can ship those at lower prices. So our vision with this product is IoT, facial recognition, they're all sort of abstract concepts that we will see in the future integrated into our homes, and this is a precursor, an easy and entertaining way to bring it into users' homes, and we see the applications as endless. So we're looking forward for everyone to see our demo today, and that's Dora.
In terms of the facial recognition, did you guys actually use API calls, or did you guys build that system yourselves?
So originally, we were going to build that system ourselves with Azure, but then we found Project Oxford, which I think one of you guys worked on. And it's really simple. Like, it's just a simple API, like GET and then a POST request. And then we've interfaced that on our web app, as well as using the client library in our Windows apps.
And how good is a projectile aiming?
I would say it's pretty decent, because like it shoots pretty fast and like accurately, and it hurts a bit sometimes, but it's fun.
Yeah, you might want to integrate with GunLock, so that could be interesting. So, you know, what are you planning to do with the database of faces that you're collecting? Like, what's the security around that, or do you have ideas about monetizing that data later?
So right now, it is a personal entertainment system. You can easily add friends and delete them just as easily. We haven't scaled that to have a lot of faces if we were to put it in a corporate environment or in a really public space. It's more for your personal private space where other people are walking around. If we were to expand, we have talked about other applications where we forego the gun, use it in public spaces such as in airports where you're always searching for your information, and screens around you would be able to tell you that information based on your face. So in that way, we would be able to monetize and store that data. But right now, we are an entertainment system and not a security system.
How many do you think you can sell, and what did you base that math off of?
Right. So again, our market is adolescents and young adults. So we see college students as primarily being the main market, and we would probably anticipate if there's four students in one apartment would have one unit in their system. So in terms of numbers, we haven't looked into specifics, but if we had various universities buy into this, and we've really focused on marketing on social media and other venues that college students really look at, we could see this being really successful. Yeah.
Have you had any customers yet or any other test cases besides within your group?
So we haven't found any like test cases yet, but we demonstrated this at our university and a lot of people were actually like interested in like giving us scenarios where they would want to use this idea. And it was mostly like college dorm, like upper level college dorms, people that weren't living in dorms, but like apartments where they didn't want people to steal their things or like they wanted to like only allow certain people to come. So we've definitely seen interest at universities, but we haven't actually put our app out there yet.
Could you do raccoon recognition? Because I got a raccoon that sneaks in my cat door and eats my cat food in my kitchen. Oh, really?
I'm not 100% sure.
I'd buy the heck out of that product.
I'm not sure how, like, Project Oxford does have some kind of, like, face, like, mapping system, but I don't know if it can get a raccoon's face yet.
Project Oxford actually has quite a elaborate catalog on dogs.
Oh.
But no raccoons, to my knowledge.
Sorry.
If rather than just using face recognition, if we also use like finding objects, we can be able to find raccoons or any other animal you want. So we would make add that to the database if you wanted to.
No more questions? All right. Thank you so much.
Give Dora a round of applause again. One more. Thank you. And next up, we have Team Tactile. Welcome them to the stage, everyone.
Hi, everyone. We are Team Tactile. We're from MIT, and we created a real-time text-to-braille converter. So this is Paul Paravano, and he's the MIT co-director of community relations, and he's our community partner on this project. So Paul lost his vision when he was 3 years old, and he explains that for many, reading something like the label on a razor packaging is trivial, but for Paul, he needs help from his friends or family because current assistive technology cannot accurately transcribe what's on the label. As a result, Paul feels a loss of independence because he needs help with something that he thinks is insignificant. So that's why we created Tactile, to address three major issues that the 285 million visually impaired people like Paul around the world faces. So the three issues are accessibility, affordability, and applicability. So for the large amount of printed text out there, not many have Braille or audio versions, and many will never have that, such as the razor packaging label. So this really limits the access to information that people who are visually impaired can have access to. Another issue is affordability. These Braille devices cost in the thousands of dollars, and they can become unaffordable for those in the lower income bracket. And lastly, we know that there are apps that can do text to audio translation. However, sometimes audio may not be the most applicable solution. It can be disruptive or inappropriate in some situations. So Tactile addresses these issues because it's the first commercial product that can do printed text to Braille, and it's portable and on demand. So with Tactile, someone who is visually impaired can pull out a textbook or any printed text and scan the text, and they will immediately get the Braille translation through our refreshable Braille display. Tactile is made possible by using Windows 10 IoT on the Raspberry Pi, as well as Microsoft Project Oxford's text detection API. We are also using servo motors to move the Braille blocks. But for our next iteration, we are looking into magnetic dipole actuators. These actuators will allow us to vastly shrink down our prototype so we can make a more compact and a full-scale Braille display. We also want to add additional features such as refresh buttons or restart buttons. So this is the current competitive landscape in Braille technology. There are Braille ebooks, but these are still under development and they cannot read printed text. They require you to upload electronic documents. With Tactile, you are able to have this freedom to read any printed text. And there are also refreshable braille displays. But these are used more as a personal computer. So they're not very portable. And again, they cannot read printed text. And lastly, as we mentioned before, there are text-to-audio apps. However, audio is not can sometimes be disruptive. So when Paul, who frequently meets with senators and the MIT president, is at a meeting, he does not want to have a headphone in. It's kind of unprofessional. But with tactile, he can read the itinerary or the pamphlet with ease without being disruptive. So we've come a long way since we started at a hackathon less than 2 months ago, and we've continued to iterate and improve our product. So we're on our fourth prototype right now, and we received a lot of positive feedback, and we are really thankful for all the support we've gotten so far. And now Bonnie will discuss the market.
With Tactile, we want to help the 285 million people who are visually impaired worldwide. In US alone, if we can capture 1% of that market, we can sell 73,000 devices. And with our estimated price at $500 per device, which is 50% less than the current Braille technologies, our projected revenue is around $36.5 million. And in order to execute our innovation, first, we're collaborating with Paul, as mentioned by Jalen, and the Perkins School for the Blind in Massachusetts to continue to iterate and refine our design. Then we're going to file for a patent, and finally we're going to manufacture and distribute our product through the National Braille Press. So we know that this is a very challenging problem that we're tackling as a team, but I'm very confident in our team's ability. Not only do we have strong technical skills from MIT, we also have business as well as startup experiences from our internships. And we have also received a lot of help from professionals in industry and academics ever since the start of our project. So we created Tactile, a real-time text-to-braille converter. And we're really excited in the direction that our team is headed towards. And we hope you are too. Thank you.
We're going to open it up for our judges.
So what is the scanning mechanism? And that outputs, I'm guessing, to the Tactile actually device. But what text input mechanisms do you guys actually use?
So currently, we're using a webcam to capture images. And since we've used a Raspberry Pi, we connect the webcam to the Raspberry Pi. And then on a click of a button, we capture the image, make an API call, and then get the output, and then send the letters with the signals for which pin should move to our Braille display.
What is the feedback from the community been? And I'm particularly interested in like the social stigma. So you talked about the awkwardness of wearing something, and this device presumably is less stigma around. So what have you heard from the community?
So we've been working with Paul, our community partner, and he's been helping us with design and how and what he wants to see from the device. So one thing he did emphasize is that he doesn't want to be wearing a headphone during the meeting because it's disruptive, and he would really want something that's portable that he can carry around and translate in real time. And we're also going to work with the Perkins School for the Blind, which is only like 30 minutes away from campus, to work with students so they can use our technology for educational purposes.
How is it powered? You know, is it battery powered, or how long does that last?
So it's currently battery powered, and for the final device, we're planning to use rechargeable batteries. So it'll last for an entire day.
And you mentioned the Braille Institute, or you mentioned a manufacturing partner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the National Braille Press. So currently, they help a lot of technologies and innovations in the Braille assistive technology, and they will actually feature them on their website. And they have a lot of connections with manufacturers and distributors in the assistive technology field. And I know Paul currently is also getting like technologies and devices from the National Braille Press. So they're definitely a very viable partner to work with.
So So people who are visually impaired usually don't go on Amazon to search for products. So they really rely on word of mouth or some notable association like the National Braille Press. So they're the main source for commercial products.
What size is the device right now?
So right now the size of the device is kind of like this. It's a little bit large. You'll see at our demo expo. And we've been shrinking it down through all our prototypes. And so hopefully in the end we'll get a much smaller and compact device like this.
What have been your biggest challenges in developing this?
So actually, developing it was a challenge. You would think that just like a small linear motion would be like easy. But actually, we've been thinking through a lot of like different mechanisms. And so currently we use servo motors, but we're planning to use magnetic dipole actuators. And we've looked into material science solutions such as shape memory alloys and piezoelectrics. And so it's just it's very challenging in terms of like in our final prototype, we have to get 260 pins to move up and down, which is a lot to power, a lot to control. So that's probably our biggest challenge right now.
What's the barrier to entry for one of the current devices? I noticed one of your competitors, the main difference was they can't read labels. So I guess what's the barrier to entry for that product to start being able to read labels?
Okay. So barrier to entry in terms of market, what is just in terms of?
In terms of your competitors, what's your competitive advantage?
Okay. I guess our biggest competitor is the LDL to the text to LDL. So what they can do is they can take a picture of the razor label, and then they can convert it to audio. But in this case, as a person who is visually impaired, it would be really hard to align your camera in a certain way to take the picture in the first case and then translate that to audio. And audio in a lot of cases is quite disruptive. So if you are talking to someone and then there's a headpiece kind of telling you the information, it could be quite disruptive. So in this case, our device, it's silent and it's a lot less disruptive. Yeah.
I want to give a round of applause for Tactile, Team Tactile. And last, but certainly not least, in the innovation category, we have Team IoT. Team IoT, give a round of applause.
Hello, my name is Gennaro DeLuca, and today I'm going to be talking to you about the Visual IoT and Robotics Programming Language Environment, or VIPL for short. So for many students, learning the first programming language can be a very difficult or frustrating experience. For example, my mentor's son was very interested in learning programming, so naturally he took an Intro to Programming course, which used Java, which is a common language to use in Intro to Programming courses. Unfortunately, due to the difficulty that arises from using text-based programming languages, there's a high barrier to entry. You have to understand all the syntax before you can really get into the programming concepts. He unfortunately ended up leaving computer science and deciding to go into electrical engineering just because of this barrier to entry. I think it's important to note here that programming is much more about the algorithms rather than the syntax. So it makes sense to focus on the algorithms in the beginning instead of spending one or two intro classes just learning the syntax of languages. According to the National Center for Education Statistics, 59% of computer science students do not graduate with a computer science degree as a result of the difficulty of intro classes, as I just mentioned. So since text-based languages seem to be one of the main issues here, one of the logical solutions is to use a visual programming language instead. There are several visual programming languages that are already used in education, such as Alice, Lego has their own EV3 visual programming language, and then there's Microsoft's Robotic Developer Studio visual programming language. And unlike the first two, Microsoft's visual programming language has sufficient features to teach an entire programming class, everything you would need to teach a student so that they could leave the course and be able to jump into some other language or some other class and get programming right away. So in 2006, in fall, Arizona State University adopted Microsoft visual programming language, and we had great success with it, actually. Unfortunately, in 2014, support ended for Microsoft VPL, and so we had to come up with a substitute. Thus, we developed VIPL. VIPL is, in a sense, an extension of Microsoft's VPL, in that it has very similar user interface, the activities work very similarly, and so forth. Like Microsoft VPL, it is very much focused on the visualization of your code and your algorithms through the drag and drop blocks, and it also has robotics included as well. And I think robotics is an important thing to include in an intro class, as it gives students something physical to work with as opposed to some abstract program that they might write and not see the direct consequences of. In addition, it gives them something to have fun with, keep them interested so that they can at least make it beyond the first intro level class. It also comes with a Unity 3D simulator in case they don't want to work with physical robots. So here's a drive-by-wire example in VIPL. What I want you to get from this example is first how simple it is to handle events, spawn threads, interface with robots. The idea is that these difficulties, the syntactic complexities, are abstracted away so that they can just focus on the algorithms behind all this, and so they can learn how to actually program instead of just learning a programming language. It's also important to note that these robot activities will work with any robot. All you need to do is create slight configuration changes, and you can use it on the simulator or a robot that you've built yourself. So we started using VIPL at ASU last summer. We taught it to the high school robotics camp that we normally have. And this semester, we're actually using it to teach one section of our Intro to Engineering course. We hope that in about 2 years, we should have all 50 sections of Intro to Engineering using VIPL, which totals at about 2,000 engineering students. We've also developed a robot kit so that users and the students can build their own robots and then program it too, so they have the whole process from beginning to end. Add a bit more fun to it, give them more experiences. Now, this kit we can build for about $150, and we estimated we can sell it for about $200. This is valuable because, first off, it's about half the price of the LEGO EV3 counterpart. In addition, our robot was designed to work especially well with VIPL and comes with free open source middleware that you can install on it if you want quick start, and you can customize it if you want to use your own sensors or you want to get into more advanced concepts with your students that the original middleware doesn't support. Thanks to help from Intel and UCLA, we have started distributing this VIPL and the curriculum we've developed to universities all over the US, and we've also taught it to several professors from both China and Vietnam who have worked with ASU in the past and who are now actually using it in their own classroom and have demoed to us some of their robots and some of their devices that their students have developed. So we hope in the future that even more universities all over the country and the world will be able to start using VIPL. Thank you.
We're going to open it up for questions with the judges.
So how many students right now are actually using the programming language?
At ASU, it's one section, so that's about 50 students.
So what is the dev environment? So does it function within like an IDE or like Visual Studio? Like
you're asking what VIPL is?
Yeah. No, I'm asking what is the dev environment?
The dev environment? Yeah. So that would be VIPL. So that's the environment that the students will program in. And that's an IDE written in C#. So it's a whole other IDE.
C#.
Yeah.
So how do you plan to distribute? Are you going from university to university? Or how do you plan on selling this?
Sure. On part, it's going to actual universities and talking to the professors there. As I've mentioned, we have some professors that already work with ASU and who are helping us, and we've also got some partners, Intel, UCLA, who are also further helping us spread VIPL around. Since the software is free, it's much more easy to distribute it without having to completely sell them on it.
And how do you plan on monetizing?
The monetization will come from the robot kits. As I mentioned, we can make some profit off of them. They're less expensive than the LEGO, and they also work really well. They're optimized to work well with VIPL.
And so you're distributing the software on GitHub or something like that?
Yeah, we just uploaded a compiled version of the VIPL onto our home website.
And do you have any estimates, like, so on the monetization front, so like how many of those robot kits do you think, do you have any sort of forecast?
Well, just considering ASU alone, as I mentioned, in about 2 years we should have all 2,000 engineering students using it every year. And so estimating that you sell robots for the class every 3 or 4 years, because that's about how long they last, that's about $50 times however many robots 2,000 students need, so 500, 1,000.
So one of your primary premises in your opening remarks was the text-based languages being intimidating mm-hmm. and ultimately driving kids away from CS. Do you have any data that suggests that VIPL does a better job of that?
The idea on that is that Arizona State University used the Microsoft VPL for all those years with great success, and the student enrollment went up. They didn't have as much issue with dropouts. And so the idea is, since we based it on the exact same concepts and it's basically the same software with just some advanced features, it should have the exact same results.
I would actually be really curious in, I've actually seen people teach robotics to children, mm-hmm. and I've actually seen like 8 and 9 year old little girls programming C just to get their little cat bot moving. And I would actually be really interested in doing like a double blind study or a comparison on groups of like first year students to see, you know, how after 6 months of actually using VIPL versus using X programming language and environment as an early first learning platform, at the end of that, do the students actually, which cohort of students actually shows better understanding of fundamental core concepts? I think that if you could actually prove that, and I suspect that you would win, I think that would actually be a huge push across to actually push VIPL and have a visual programming language as opposed to a text-based programming language for intro classes.
I agree. I think it's also important to show that they can transition into text-based languages and doesn't lock them out of that.
Cool. Everyone give a round of applause to Team IoT.